On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Tuesday morning, in the Sicilian town of Corleone, no less, Italian police moved in on Italy's most wanted man, top boss of the Cosa Nostra, the chief of chiefs, the capo di capi. After 43 years of eluding capture, Bernardo Provenzano was grabbed in a farmhouse a mile outside the town that gave Hollywood's Godfather movies their family name. Yesterday, the Corleone Town Council declared April 11th Liberation Day, the end of a long, dark night. But the mafia story is not over in Italy, and globally, organized crime now has many faces. Up next on Point, the mafia and organized crime in an era of globalization and terror. We will speak in this hour to those who have lived under the cloud of mafia oppression and those who have studied organized crime in Italy and around the world. But we begin in Rome with Gabe Kahn. He's a correspondent there for the Wall Street Journal for the latest on the arrest of Cosa Nostra kingpin Bernardo Provenzano. Gabe Kahn, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Where is Mr. Provenzano at this point?
He's in one of Italy's highest security prisons in Umbria, far away from Sicily in the center of Italy. Doing what's called 41 bis, which is a particular type of hard time that's reserved specifically for mafia bosses.
We heard the town of Corleone celebrating there in a proclamation by its town council. How has the arrest been received among Italians more widely, Gabe?
Well, I think, first of all, there's a good deal of surprise because this man had been wanted for so long that a lot of people thought that he might never surface again. His lawyer recently gave an interview saying, no, he's been dead for years.
Right. We saw that April 1st the report was out. Yeah.
Exactly. And so I think that this is certainly a real feather in the cap of the police here in Italy.
What's the role and the structure that held the capo di tutti i capi, the chief of chiefs? What was his role exactly there?
Well, I think first and foremost, he's the man who sort of keeps the peace. He is the man who makes sure that the different factions within Cosa Nostra are evenly balanced, that people aren't killing each other on the streets. Really, we haven't seen a lot of mafia bloodshed in Italy since 1992, 1993. And often what people say is that the more peace you see on the streets is actually a sign of strength of the mafia, not of weakness.
Provenzano said to the police when he was arrested in a farmhouse a mile outside of Corleone, you don't know what you're doing. How's that being interpreted? What does he mean?
Well, there's a number of interpretations to that. It could be something benign, but some people also feel that really what he means is that if you remove me from the top, you don't know what's gonna bubble up afterwards. He certainly had done an effective job of keeping what would otherwise be warring factions from killing each other. And now that he's gone, there's a lot of people feel that there's going to be a power struggle and perhaps even a generational power struggle to fill that spot.
Who was this man, Provenzano, and how did he rise to this position?
Well, I think there's a lot of mystery about how he rose to this position, but certainly he's from this area, the same area where he was captured. And I think that's also really an important aspect of the mafia's strength. They're very deeply embedded into the culture of this countryside of Sicily, outside of Corleone. That's what enabled him to be on the run for so long without anybody catching him. You've got a wide network of accomplices, of ordinary citizens who know how to mind their own business, and that's really what keeps the mafia strong.
Now, Italy's mafia is not monolithic. There are different wings, different organizations entirely. How big a portion of the Italian mafia does the Sicilian, the Cosa Nostra mob, represent?
Well, that's a very interesting question. The answer is less and less. The authorities have had some serious success in combating the Sicilian mafia. One, because there was the political will to do it, especially after the bloodshed of 92-93, also because there was an emerging citizens movement to sort of fight the mafia. And once you really take away the protection which the mafia enjoys amongst the populace, you've really weakened the structure. That's happened to quite a degree in Sicily. Where it hasn't happened so far is across the straits in Calabria, where another organized crime network called the 'Ndrangheta has really grown and filled the void that the retreating Sicilian mafia has left behind.
They're in the toe of the boot of Italy, and the Calabrian mafia much more globally active.
Absolutely. It's really quite an impressive organization if you were to look at it as a business model. Calabrian mafia have organizations in Australia, in Canada, in Northern Europe. They have direct dealings with the Colombian cocaine cartels, and they generate a tremendous amount of money.
Revenues of $40 to $50 billion just in the last few years, we read. That's big business.
Absolutely. And then, of course, that money has to be recycled and washed and reinserted into the regular economy somehow, too, and they've become very good at that.
Gabe, we're going to hear a lot more about the mafia in this hour, but what's the overall sense? Do Italians feel they're getting a handle on this, or is this just an eternal struggle that they'll be involved in?
Listen, I think at this point, you know, this is not the first boss of bosses who's been arrested. I think that this is, everybody would agree that this is a struggle for the long haul. There's certainly a transformation that the mafia and organized crime has been undertaking recently. It's not the first transformation. They've been very good at adapting and basically changing with the times. So I think that people feel that this is a situation that's not going to go away just with one arrest.
We're going to dig in. Gabe, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Gabe Kahn, Rome correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Joining me now from London is Simonetta Agnello Hornby. She grew up in Sicily and still visits often. She's the author of a book on the origins of the mafia called Zia Marchesa, and also author of the novel The Almond Picker. Simonetta Agnello Hornby, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
You've written and spoken movingly about how the mafia was very much a presence in your childhood in Sicily, where you were part of an old and prominent family, but that prominence by no means protected you or your father or your family from the influence of the mafia.
Well, I come from the landed gentry, people who had estates. In my particular case, the low aristocracy. Mafia was born at the beginning of two centuries ago, in the 19th century, on the estates, because Sicily had feudalism until 1812. The barons had to keep the army of bailiffs to keep order and to impart some justice. When feudalism disappeared, the bailiffs, who were violent and ruthless, had no role, no institutional role. So that was the origin of mafia. So mafia originally, until really the middle of the last century, was purely in the countryside and only in western Sicily, where I come from, where the landed estates were. So I did know the mafia because we, all my family and my relatives had land, and mafia was in each estate. You couldn't eradicate it. And, you know, I'm ashamed to say, particularly in the past, mafia and the landowners had the same aim as the politicians, to keep the status quo.
Remind us, take us back to your childhood and the interactions of your family and the mafia, your real fear and the place it had in your child's mind in those days.
I knew of mafia almost as I knew of eating, school, God. It was part of society. My father was against the mafia, and he paid a high price for that. We knew that you couldn't speak too much in the country. If you visited somebody else, you had to be careful, because you never know who is an informer of mafia. It could be a servant. It could be somebody you meet. We knew that mafia was a cloud in our life. When I was a child, I don't have brothers. I only have a sister. We were allowed to go around in our country estate where the staff were not part of mafia. Other relatives had estates where they couldn't go because mafia was dominating it. But mafia in those days didn't take girls, so we could go around. But when my male cousins came, there were periods when suddenly we couldn't go out. When we went into the fields, we always had an overseer armed coming near us, keeping discreet watch.
You write about a moment when the conflict got real, when trees on your family's land were burnt, and your father, revenge, had sheep killed? Whose? One for one?
Well, what happens is that if you want to establish something, if you want to change a culture, if you want to bring novelties, mafia doesn't like it unless it comes in partnership. And there are messages of mafia. There is a language of communicating. You will burn a tree. You will cause some havoc on the on a field, and that's a message. And their messages back, and the message back in that particular case was, I shall have some of my sheep killed. You can eat them, but they're killed. And that's a way of communicating, I'm not afraid. My father, when I was a child, used to have, for a period, messages saying, don't go out at midnight. In Sicily, in the summer, you do go out at night. And my father would go every night to have an ice cream at midnight. And I remember Mama didn't want him to go. And then she said, then I'll come with you.
Simonetta Aniela Hornby, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
We're joined now from Freiburg, Germany, by Letizia Paoli. She's senior researcher at the Max Planck Institute for Foreign and International Criminal Law, author of Mafia Brotherhoods, Organized Crime Italian Style. She served as a consultant to the Italian Ministry of Interior and to the Italian Organized Crime Task Force. Letizia Paoli, thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
It's great to have you. So here's the story of Bernardo Provenzano. And we're reading, I don't know, the so-called boss of bosses accused of more than 100 murders. Legend has it that he strangled no less than 50 people, but he also apparently ran an enormous, far-reaching organization. What's the significance, to your mind, of his capture this week?
Well, I mean, certainly his arrest is a major blow to Cosa Nostra, but we should also not overestimate the relevance of his arrest. Cosa Nostra is a confederation of about 100 mafia families and composed of 3,500 maid members at least. And, of course, despite the arrest of Provenzano's, the families are just going on with the businesses. You have also to consider that, contrary to the view popularized by the media and by the movies, Cosa Nostra is a confederation, as I said. So this means that the single mafia families enjoy quite a high degree of autonomy and are free to go on with their businesses, to set up and organize their businesses as they want. And they will certainly go on doing so despite the arrest of Provenzano.
Letizia Paoli, a lot of Americans will have their image of the mafia from, as you say, the movies, The Godfather, from television, The Sopranos. You talk about the business of the Cosa Nostra. What is that these days, or the businesses? What's the activity of this organized crime world?
So since the early 90s, at least, Cosa Nostra has very much retreated into Sicily. It has been very much marginalized from most international criminal trades. It used to play in the early 70s and 80s a major role in heroin smuggling, but during the 80s, Cosa Nostra was marginalized by the trafficking. It has had difficulties entering other illegal markets, either because of the Cosa Nostra's normative codes, because that code does not allow the trade in certain goods, or because the mafiosis do not possess the necessary know-how. For example, the prohibition of exploiting prostitution has prevented the Cosa Nostra from entering into the new business of trafficking in human beings. And as a result, since the 90s, since the early 90s, Cosa Nostra has very much receded into its strongholds, in particular into Western Sicily, and avoiding international competition. And today, the mafiosi obtain a growing and preponderant quota of the revenues by manipulating the tendering process of public works and by imposing a generalized extortion regimes on all the economic enterprises of Western Sicily.
So we read that they're very deep now in construction, as you say, public works projects. And that extortion you're talking about, how widespread is that in Western Sicily today, Palermo and beyond? I mean, does every business have to pay up? Is it just businesses at the margins? What does it look like?
I mean, it's hard to find hard data on that, huh? Because reports, citizens' reports of extortions are very limited. And even the few studies that have been attempted have just met with people's fears to talk about it. But according to Pentiti's, to mafia defectors and recent investigations, the extortions regime is very generalized. Apparently, Provenzano introduced the rules that everybody has to pay though the sums that are extorted are lower than in the past.
And what about in the political realm? We also read that the influence goes very, very high these days, that the Cosa Nostra has reached right into the centers of power very effectively. What do you see there?
I mean, again, it's another topic on which it is difficult to find hard proof of many allegations, but it's a fact that Silvio Berlusconi, our prime minister...
For the moment.
Yeah, for the moment, has been investigated for mafia collusion. It is a fact that his former right-hand, Marcello Dell'Utri, has been convicted for mafia collusion to 9 years of imprisonment, though it is still a first-degree sentence. And it is a fact that, that Giulio Andreotti, who was for 7 times prime minister of Italy, has been investigated, though in the end acquitted, for mafia collusion. And it's a fact that many lower-ranking politicians, mostly belonging to the right-wing parties, have been convicted for mafia collusion. So, Cosa Nostra still seems to enjoy quite a widespread net of political collusion.
And here, this week, such a big election in Italy, it looks like Silvio Berlusconi will give way to Romano Prodi. We'll talk about that more later in the hour. But there's been a lot of speculation about the fact that this arrest of the chief of chiefs, Provenzano, came in the same week of this apparent loss of power by Berlusconi. What do you make of that? Any relationship between the election and the arrest?
I've also read the speculations, but I don't think that there is a direct link. The police, the law enforcement agencies have been, for 40 years, behind Provenzano. And I'm sure that as soon as they've seen a possibility to catch him, they just tried. So I don't think that there has been any tactical reasoning on the part of law enforcement agencies.
Letizia Paoli, please stand by. I want to invite our listeners in. Paul's calling from Chevy Chase, Maryland. Hi, Paul, you're on the air.
Oh, yeah, hi. Well, actually, I formulated my question before your guest started to talk about exactly what I want to ask about. Maybe I could ask her to get a little deeper into it. The issue of how illegal money is recycled through legitimate businesses and how they actually make more money on those businesses. And I understood, I've spent a lot of time in Italy, I understand that the mafia has gotten deeply into, as she said, public works projects like big highway construction and also this big high-speed train network that's being built now. And I don't know if she's familiar with a book by Ferdinando Imposimato called Corruption at High Velocity that talked a lot about that.
Letizia Paoli, how deeply and how into the business world and how sophisticated that involvement now?
As I said, the manipulation of this public work tendering, and I mean not only the construction of highways, but also, for example, health services are a big business, and also the recycling industry has also become a big business. So this is the major source of revenues for the Cosa Nostra now, and this is also an activity that, as a matter of fact, hardly requires any money laundering because the money is already invested in illicit activities.
Mm-hmm.
So there is no need to launder it. So
it's legal. These are government projects, and the Cosa Nostra is set in position to get them, to get the contracts.
Yes, it is in the position to get the contract. And indeed, the novelties of the last 15 years is that the Cosa Nostra enterprise, the Cosa Nostra construction firms, no longer get just subcontracts as they used to do up to the late 80s, but they're now very much sitting at the same table together with corrupt politicians and with large national building companies to decide how to split the tenders.
Letizia Paoli in Freiburg, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Letizia Paoli, author of Mafia Brotherhoods, Organized Crime Italian Style. We're joined now from Oxford, England, by Federico Varese. He lectures in criminology at Oxford University. He is author of The Russian Mafia, Private Protection in a New Market Economy. He was recently a visiting professor at Yale. Federico Varese, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
And with us from Washington, Peter Reuter, professor of criminology at the University of Maryland, senior economist at the Rand Corporation, author of Disorganized Crime. Peter Reuter, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
Federico Varese, first to you. We hear a lot about the Russian mob and different kinds of organized crime all around the world today. Your sense of the Cosa Nostra and the Italian mafia more broadly, how big a player is it today? Is it now a minor player? Is it still got a big seat at the table of organized crime?
The Cosa Nostra. Well, I think Cosa Nostra has lost the ability to manipulate great trade, especially the heroin trade. So I think it is retreated quite a lot in Western Sicily, as Professor Pari was saying. Now, it doesn't make it less dangerous, because in a sense, having a territorial control is a strong asset, because then from that territory you can, you know, influence the banking system of the country and do many more things. So in a sense, from my understanding, that Cosa Nostra has a very strong, firm control on the territory. And depending on international regulations and the pressure from the state, especially the Italian state and now the European Union, it's able to either survive on the little territory or expand. So certainly police pressure needs to be kept on the Sicilian mafia, which is actually what has been going on in the past 10 years.
And Peter Reuter, when you look more broadly at the Russian mob and others, and then at the Italian mafia overall, including across the straits there, the Calabrian mafia, more active internationally, how do you see the Italian mafia comparing in its operations, in its scale these days to, I guess, what we might call its competitors on the world scene?
Well, I think internationally it's a fairly minor player. I mean, if you expand the term organized crime to include large-scale drug trafficking, the mafia is really quite a minor player, whether it's the Italian, Sicilian and Calabrian groups or the American groups. They have basically not been players in the cocaine traffic or methamphetamine or any of the other drugs post-heroin.
So that's got them sidelined. Who's picked up the slack? Are we talking really Colombians here? What about the scale of Russian mob operations?
Well, again, sticking with drug trafficking for a moment, it varies very much by country. If you go to Western Europe, it does tend to be very specific immigrant groups. For example, in Denmark, it's basically West Africans, and there's sort of curious historical explanation for that. In Britain, the traffic is predominantly Turkish with a bit of Albanian or Balkan nationals thrown in. In the U.S., the cocaine trade is Mexican and Colombian, and the methamphetamine trade is all Mexican, so it varies, and a lot of it has to do just with the migration patterns. I mean, the reason, one of the major reasons that Colombians are so important in the cocaine trade here is that Colombia has the largest immigrant population from South America, much larger than that from Brazil or Argentina. And that means that there's sort of a rich, you know, a thick pipeline of traffic and commerce in which the cocaine can be buried. Whereas in Western Europe, the immigrants come from somewhere else and they provide the pipeline.
Federico Varese, you've taught recently in the States. You taught a course on comparative mafiology. Does the Italian mafia feel sidelined? Does it feel diminished by the growth of organized crime from other bases around the world, or is it just fine, thank you, operating the Cosa Nostra primarily now out of Sicily? Is that enough?
You mean if they're kind of the envious of their competitors?
Yes.
And I've been recently looking at cases of the Russian mafia, which is actually what I work on most of the time, trying to expand into Italy. And I've read extensive wiretap evidence from the Italian police of this Russian group trying to expand into Italy. And one of the things the Russian mafioso said is, we should not go to Sicily because there is where the Sicilian mafia is strong. We should try to expand and open up a branch in Rome. So, in a sense, the Sicilians still have a very strong hold in Western Sicily. But as Professor Reuter was saying, I think they have completely moved out or been pushed out of the big international trade, especially drugs. And as we know, the reason why they were able to be in that market before is because they were able to control with the American partners and brothers, the Italian-American mafia in New York, to control the docks of New York, and a lot of drugs was going through then, that part of the United States and coming from the East. Now drugs comes into from everywhere, and as Professor Reuter was saying, they come from immigrant communities of all kinds. And so they certainly have lost that monopoly, of which they were very good at. But they're still extremely powerful in the region, and so in a sense they're a major threat to the stability of Sicily.
Peter Reuter, what about the mafia, the Italian-American mafia in the U.S.? If the Italian mafia is become a bit player on the world scene, does that mean that its cousins in the States are also diminished in their relative importance in this world?
They are diminished. I don't think it has any connection with the decline of the Sicilian mafia. They're really very independent organizations and have been that way for 50 years at least. I think in part it's again immigration, which, I mean, the American mafia recruited from first or second generation poorly educated Italian males. Well, you know, in the last 50 years, there haven't been a lot of poorly educated Italian immigrants coming in. And so I think their sort of natural talent pool has gotten pretty thin. They've been very unimpressive. The leadership aged, was very sort of slow to adapt to changes in American policing and politics. I just think it's sort of the general motives of the criminal world.
Carl's calling from Randolph, Massachusetts. Hi, Carl. You're on the air.
Okay, great show. 2 points and one question for your guests.
Yeah.
In any organized society, you're always going to find this kind of organized crime because they help the society somehow. Because if you look at the time of Al Capone, somehow government always part of the organized crime. I don't know how, but it's part of the economy. They, like your guest said, they use illicit money to wash up and to infiltrate in the economy. And this is part of our economy, and it's very hard. For example, like fake money, counterfeit money.
Counterfeit. So where are you going, Carl? Are you saying it's always going to be with us, nothing we can do about it, but yet it rises and falls in power?
Nothing you can do about it because you get rid of the mafia, even you give mafia a bad rap. But if you look at other international and national organized crime, they're all part of our society. And then we know the Federal Reserve knows that we have a lot of counterfeit money, but they let it go because publicize it too much, that's probably going to collapse our economy and it's going to create some kind of a negative effect.
Well, I don't know. Counterfeiting seems to come from all over the place. Even North Korea accused of major counterfeiting recently. Carl, thanks for your call. Federico Varese, you've lectured about and written about the conditions that give rise to organized crime, mafia-style crime. Carl says it's always with us, but what are the conditions that make it particularly likely?
Yes, exactly. I think there are some very specific conditions that are actually shared by all of the mafias, the major mafia groups that we know, in at least the five major mafias around the world. And in very short, these conditions are the following. All of the mafias we know, the Sicilian mafia, the triads in Hong Kong, the Japanese Yakuza, the Russian mafia, and also the Italian-American mafia in some way, emerge at the time of a transition. In the four cases I've just described, they emerge at the transition from feudalism to a market economy. And when this transition is flawed, the state is not able to define property rights, to provide protection for the new actors in the market economy. And so a demand for protection that is not met by the state is met by these criminals. Now, most of the criminals that end up becoming the Sicilian mafia, the Russian mafia, and so on and so forth, actually are people trained in the use of violence. So they are a supply of violent people who are then employed in this private market.
So they've likely been in war or in a military or something.
Exactly. So they could be disbanded soldiers from the Bourbon army that was defeated in Sicily in the 19th century, or field guards in the estates that we were talking about earlier. They could be former Afghan fighters in the Russian army or the Soviet army that were disbanded at the time of the transition to the market economy in Russia. And so I think if you have this framework in mind, you cannot say that mafias are everywhere. I mean, in the country I live in the UK, there is no mafia of this kind. So it's not that mafias are everywhere. There are very specific organizations that emerge at a very specific time under very specific conditions. Unfortunately, once they have emerged, are very hard to get rid of because some people do benefit from their existence.
No kidding. Luciano's calling from Washington. Hi, Luciano. You're on the air.
How are you today?
Very well. What do you know?
At one time in the late 1980s, the early 1990s, I was the U.S. Consul General in Palermo.
Oh, right in the middle of things.
Yes. While I was there, many of the people that I talked to, both from the law enforcement world and politics, were getting killed. One must remember, I have to agree with some of the previous callers, but also with your guests, that the mafia right now is in a state of abeyance. They kind of have retreated, but this is not the first time that they have done so.
Mm-hmm.
If we go back to 1926, when Mussolini was a dictator in Italy, he sent a prefect to Sicily by the name of Moro,
mm-hmm.
and for a while, by using legal and extra-legal means, he claimed to have disbanded the mafia. In fact, that happened was that the mafia even got to Mussolini, and politicians started putting some pressure on Mussolini, who then gave a medal to his prefect who was fighting the mafia and pensioned them off.
But so, Mussolini, as you say, very tough on them and very effective at that, at least for a while, but yet things come back. Luciano, our time is short. I want to put to Peter Reuter this issue of the ebb and flow of organized crime.
Sure.
Mr. Reuter, what about, in an age of a globalizing economy, does that help or hurt? Does it create more opportunities or does it sort of systemize and contain organized crime?
Well, it changes the set of opportunities. But I think one thing that's interesting from what your previous caller said about Mussolini and the decline of the mafia is that in a setting in which you have dictatorial authority and reasonably effective ones, it's not so hard to suppress the mafia. What's interesting is the decline of the mafia in the U.S. over the last 30 years or so, which I think is quite an important phenomenon and reflects in this case sort of interesting transitions in just the structure of politics and policing. It used to be that if you wanted to sort of run, let's say, gambling in Miami, and this is an analysis that goes back to the work of Tom Schelling, who won the Nobel Prize this year in economics. Basically, the Miami Police Department could sort of sell the franchise for running gambling in Miami. Nobody else, no other police department was interested.
Right.
And, corrupt police department could offer the franchise, and it was cheapest to have a single collector, and that was the mafia.
So kind of one-stop shopping for the payoff.
Exactly. And now we have very fragmented policing in this country. So if you take the drug markets, you have, the Miami Police Department, and then you have a Florida State Agency and the DEA and the FBI, and they're all sort of pouring over the same set of felons. And the first thing that any drug dealer will offer up if they're caught by the feds is the name of the corrupt police officer that's protecting them. Well, corrupt police officers are wise enough to know that that's a fool's game. And basically the market for central corruption, systemic corruption of the kind that was so troubling about the mafia in the 1930s through 50s, has almost disappeared. It's not that there isn't corruption, but it just doesn't have that systemic quality, and some of the dangers that sort of came from the mafia's real involvement in the politics of so many cities in this country has largely disappeared.
Mm.
And it's sort of an interesting story about how the evolution of policing and politics can really affect the power of organized crime in a modern society.
And yet some of the headlines are still so head-turning. Here, just from a couple of weeks ago, the head of Italy's anti-mafia operations announced that a submarine was being built by the Calabrian mafia in Colombia to transport drugs and had been impounded. Federico Varese, let me turn to you on the issue of terrorism, if I may. Two questions. One, how does the mafia look at the world of terrorists, as potential partners or as enemies? And does the era of terrorism make life more difficult for the mob because security measures are so much higher?
Well, let me start from the second question. And the answer is yes. The greater the worry about terrorism, the worse the life is for the mafia. So a lot of the anti-terrorism laws that have been passed in the U.S. and in Europe aimed at terrorism first and foremost, but really who gets caught up in the net are criminals trying to go through customs with things they shouldn't be carrying. Mm. So really there is a virtuous, in a sense, a cycle in which the fight against terrorism actually helps the fight against organized crime and the mafia, which then leads me to answer in the first part of the question that at heart, organized crime and the mafias as we know them on the one hand and terrorism on the other are two very different beasts, really. The mafia does not really have a political program. They are after making money, using violence, cornering markets, trying to reduce competition, giving only some of their few friends the ability to enter a certain market. That's what the mafia really does. Mm. Terrorism has got a political aim, which is also just widespread violence, so killing whoever can be killed, while the mafia uses its violence somewhat rationally. They try to economize on the use of violence, and they only use it when they really need it. So I think they are two very different beasts. Now, does it mean that a mafioso will never, ever deal with a terrorist if it's in his short-term interest? The answer is no. Unfortunately, precisely because these people are just after money, they might well sell enriched uranium on the black market to an Arab terrorist, as a story that was in the Italian newspaper some years ago testified. So it's not that we can really say, oh, well, they are our guys, they are fighting with us against terrorism. But I think analytically we should keep them separate and understand that they're very different beasts.
We've just got a few seconds left. Federico Verzi, let me ask you, of the five mobs, international mobs that you describe, Italian, Russian, Hong Kong, Japan, the U.S., which one do you see now as most powerful, ascendant?
Well, for me, personally, I find that China, what is going on in China is extremely interesting because the Hong Kong triads are now moving into mainland China. And mainland China is one of the biggest economies in the world, is booming, and there is so much market activity. And right in the middle of this economic boom, we have new blood coming from Hong Kong, the triads of Hong Kong becoming really entrenched into this big economy. So for me, at least intellectually, I mean, I think that is extremely interesting, extremely worrying, and extremely important.
So once again, we follow the money. Federico Verzi, author of The Russian Mafia, thanks very much for being with us from Oxford today.
Thank you.
And Peter Reuter, professor of criminology at the University of Maryland. Mr. Reuter, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
This is On Point.